Coming up today, Formula One to Primo Lewis Hamilton on the science of success, activism and what comes next, and we explore the future of artificial intelligence. You're listening to the Wired UK podcast, your essential weekly catch-up on all the big stories in tech, science, business and culture. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me this week are Matt Burgess.
Hello.
Vicky Turk.
Hiya.
And Amit Katwala.
Hello.
This was the week when Deliveroo had one of the worst stock market debuts in history after major UK investors expressed major concern about its gig economy work model. More than £2 billion was wiped off the company's valuation, with shares failing to rebound on its second day of trading.
This was also the week when former British politician and now Facebook communications VP Nick Clegg wrote a post defending Facebook against the idea that the platform encourages polarisation. He argues that users bear some responsibility for what personalised algorithms show them and that it's not in Facebook's interest to push people to extreme content.
And finally, this was the week when the US agency responsible for America's nuclear weapons tweeted ...GMLXZSSAW. However, rather than being the work of inept hackers, the tweet was sent by a very young child of the agency's Twitter manager when they accessed his laptop.
Speaking of technical mishaps, regular podcast subscribers may have noticed that last week's episode didn't arrive when it should have. I think it ended up going out on Wednesday of this week rather than Friday of last, unless you subscribe through Spotify, in which case you got it when you were meant to get it. This is because we moved to a new RSS feed, and for some reason, a bunch of podcast platforms failed to spot the change. We fixed it, which is good. So hopefully you enjoyed last week's episode a couple of days ago, and now you can enjoy this week's episode right now. So we're back to our regular schedule now and back to our regular facts. Amit, what did you learn this week?
I learned that cocoa powder is hydrophobic. So if you dunk a teaspoon of cocoa powder in a glass of water, it will come out dry. I just tried this and it's the weirdest thing. And I also learned that if you pour cocoa powder all over the kitchen worktops, your wife will shout at you.
So if you poured water on top of that cocoa powder, the water would just run off?
Essentially, yeah. So what seemed to happen was that, like, so I put it on a spoon and I dunked it in and it looked like it was wet. But then when you, like, prodded it with a finger, the water just kind of went away, like slid off, and there was just dry cocoa powder underneath, which is really interesting, but also makes it a bit of a nightmare to, like, clean up because you can't, like, pick it up with anything wet like you normally would.
Fun times. It's been a long year of lockdown and Amit is having fun with cocoa powder. Matt Burgess, what did you learn this week?
Speaking of a long year of lockdown and not having much else to do, I've been really getting into trees lately and sort of interested in the trees and plants and bushes and stuff around us where I live. And I've also learned about a group of mysterious London plane trees on Kennington Road here in London. There's nothing like odd about the trees themselves, but in this sort of like row of trees, 15 of them have small little plaques attached to them. And the plaques are about 10 feet above the ground, so above people's eyeline, so you can see them if you're going by on a bus. But all of the little plaques actually have the names of Apollo-era astronauts on. So there's a tree which has got a little plaque that just says Buzz Aldrin on it. There's one that says Neil Armstrong and sort of all the others from that sort of era. And nobody really knows why they're on there. There's sort of there have been some sort of reports and local blogs and stuff like that from the last, blogs from sort of a decade ago, which said that the plaques were there 20 years previously. So they were potentially put up like 30 years ago and maybe linked to the British Interplanetary Society. But even in the Interplanetary Society's magazine, it's also said that they don't really know anything about the origin of these tiny little plaques. So, it's just a weird situation, to be honest.
How much time have you invested in trying to track down the origin of the little plaques on the trees on Kennington Road?
Not enough yet, but when I did some extra research about them for this podcast fact, and then found that there was somebody from the British Interplanetary Society who was looking into these in the past, and he had put a call out for sort of any further sort of knowledge about them. So I'm going to email him, email Colin, I think it is, and see if he ever actually found anything out about them.
Maybe there'll be an exciting follow-up fact on the podcast next week. And if you know anything about the London plane trees on Kennington Road and the Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong plaques, do get in touch. podcast@wired.co.uk. Let's see if we can solve this mystery together.
Our first story this week is our new cover story for the new print issue of Wired magazine, out wherever you buy your magazines from at the moment. Or if you're a subscriber, you've probably got it already. It's about Lewis Hamilton, the Formula One racing driver. I think now we can probably safely say as a fact that he's the best driver of all time. Last weekend, the 2021 Formula One season kicked off with a Grand Prix in Bahrain, and Hamilton took the top spot for Mercedes. It was quite a tense battle with Red Bull's Max Verstappen, but he took first place. We're by now very used to seeing him get that number one spot. By the end of last year, he'd won 95 Grand Prix, a world record, and 7 world championships. He was even knighted in the 2021 New Year honours. Amit, he is pretty much the greatest racer ever, right?
Yeah, he's level with Michael Schumacher now on world championships. And as you said, he's top of the standings by a mile on Grand Prix wins, helped partially by the fact that they do about 40 races a season now. But to be this good for this long is really, really impressive. It's been 13 years since he won his first world title. And it's not just the records and the championships, but it's the way that he wins and the way that he's continued to win, even as he's gotten older. And we saw at the weekend how he was able to fend off Verstappen, even though he was in what was clearly the slower car.
So, Amit, you wrote the cover story for us this issue, and you obviously spoke to Lewis Hamilton for this. What was he like to speak to?
Yeah, I really like him. I think he's very engaged. Like, I've spoken to a lot of F1 drivers over the years, and they tend to be quite disinterested in speaking to the press, but he's very engaged and interested, and he thinks about the questions that you ask him rather than giving the sort of media trained line in a lot of cases, so, which is quite nice. It's quite refreshing. And he's got all these other interests outside F1. So when I spoke to him, he was sitting in his music studio in Colorado with all these kind of, you know, amplifiers and mixers and things like that behind him. So you get a sense that he's got a bit more kind of personality to him than maybe some of the other drivers on the grid.
He really is at the top of his game. I mean, I hate to say it as a bit of an F1 fan, but last year's season was almost boring because of how predictably and convincingly Lewis Hamilton would win. You almost kind of wanted someone just to challenge him a bit more, just for the viewing pleasure. I mean, he was, metaphorically speaking, miles ahead of the competition in quite a few races. You've been trying to unpick what it is that gives him such an advantage. What makes him so good?
Yeah, that's right. So I spent a long time speaking to Lewis himself, plus, you know, some other former F1 drivers and experts in the area to kind of get a sense of what is it that makes him different to other drivers. And what we ended up agreeing on was that he seems to have this ability to sort of drive right on the edge without ever really going over the line. So he can push things right to the limit without crossing that invisible line that means he'd spin out or crash. And that means that he can brake later going into corners. He can carry more speed because he's so confident in his ability to get the right braking point and to push it right to the edge that he can attack corners on a track faster. And he does it without wrecking his tyres. So F1 at the moment, a lot of it is about kind of tyre management and managing the condition of your tyres. And he can do this. He can race in this aggressive style while still protecting his tyres, so that when he then does need to go fast at the end of the race, his tyres are still in the position where he can. And then that's on top of all the physical stuff, so, you know, training and mental preparation and all the other things that an F1 driver has to do to even compete at this level.
Yeah, I think sometimes people forget that F1 drivers really do need to maintain a very high level of physical fitness. You know, they are athletes. It's not just sitting in a car. The power that they need to maintain control over the vehicle at such high speeds is really something, especially when they're going around corners, which are obviously a huge part of racing, and withstanding all of the G-forces and pressure on them. I mean, if one of us went through, we'd probably just, I don't know, pass out or something. I certainly don't think we'd be able to control a car to the degree of accuracy that you need to win a race when you've got 19 other cars coming up right around you as well. And that's why F1 drivers have such wide necks, right? They have to train their neck muscles really intensely to withstand those forces. But it's obviously not just physical fitness. You mentioned there they also need to be really on it mentally, both in terms of, you know, being psychologically in the game, ready to win, but also, I guess, things like reaction speeds and keeping a clear head to respond immediately to things happening on the track when it can get a bit unpredictable. How does Hamilton approach that mental aspect of the fitness that's required?
Yeah, so I think there's a few things going on here. So I like to, when I think about these things, which I do a lot, I like to break it down into kind of sports psychology and then like sports like neurobiology, which is kind of the, I guess, the processes by which the brain processes information. So I think there's a few things going on here on that latter point. So sporting success at its heart boils down to three things. So anticipation, high-speed decision-making, and the ability to perform under pressure. So the best athletes in the world in any sport seem to have more time than everyone else, not because they're quicker or stronger, but because they've honed their sensory systems through, you know, tens of thousands of hours of practice. In a sport like football or tennis, that might be, that might mean that you are able to read the play because you pick up on advanced cues. So you, you know, rather than waiting to see where the ball's going to go, you predict where the ball's going to go based on the shape of your opponent's body or the sound of the ball leaving their foot. And it's, initially, it's difficult to see how that translates to a sport like F1, but the parallel is that athletes are skilled in these kind of mental shortcuts. They've got these strategies for breaking the world down and extracting the information from it that's relevant to them. And Hamilton was really good on this point. He talked about how when he approaches a corner, everything seems to slow down for him, like his visual field seems to widen, and he feels like he can see more than he would on a normal day. His, it's almost like his vision is sharper in that moment when he's looking for the right breaking point. And it's not just about vision. So for a lot of sports, vision is really important. There have been studies showing that, for example, the best baseball hitters have got, their visual acuity is literally better than non-athletes. They can actually see more, and that's one of the reasons why they've risen to the top of that sport. For Hamilton, it's more about feel. So he's able to tell via sort of the vibrations of the car and the seat and the steering wheel how far he can push. He's got a sense of grip, and he can read the information that's coming to him from the tyres, through the car, through those vibrations, and really, really push it to the limit because he's got such a good sense of how much grip the car has with the track. And then more recently, he's coupled that with better decision-making. So early on in his career, he had some really painful mechanical failures. Now he's in a position where he never pushes the car harder than he needs to. So, you know, he won't try and open up like a 45-second lead in the front of a race. He'll keep it to 15 seconds and maintain his tyre conditions so that then when he needs to push, the tyres are in better shape. And he really very rarely makes mistakes. And as I said, this all comes from practice, you know, tens of thousands of hours of practice from a really young age.
I guess that's the thing, right? F1 is very unusual as a sport in that so much of a driver's performance is also down to their equipment. You know, I guess every sport has equipment in terms of, you know, tennis rackets or the ball or things like that. But when you're talking racing, the driver and car almost meld into one. They have to work together. There's no doubting that Mercedes has one of the best, if not the best, cars on the track at the moment. So is Hamilton's success at least partly just down to the fact that he has got the best car?
Yeah, people like to shrug at, you know, people like to shrug at his success and dismiss it almost, you know, well, he's just got the best car, anyone could win in that car. But that's not true. And I think it overlooks the fact that building a winning car is a collaborative process where driver feedback is like really important. It's not like they just give him the cars at the start of the season and like, there you go off and win another world title. It's a process where they have to really, really work together to look for balance and balance between grip and degradation, between understeer and oversteer, between airflow and all these different things. One of the Mercedes engineers says that the driver is the most sophisticated sensor on the whole car. You know, the data that you're getting from the telemetry can only tell you so much, but if a driver has an ability to translate the feeling that they have on the steering wheel into technical, useful information that the engineers can then do to make those tweaks, that makes a massive, massive difference to the success of a team. And Hamilton was really, you know, when he joined Mercedes, it wasn't a winning team, and he really was instrumental in taking them into the position that they're in now. And I spoke to a bunch of people that he's worked with in the past, and they're all really impressed by his attention to detail, you know, his ability to learn, his willingness to learn. So he spent the winter break looking through this huge technical manual, reading all the aspects of the car for the season. he told me he takes into account things like the wind direction at specific corners on a circuit and how that might change his ability to brake earlier or later. People see him as this sort of, you know, jet-setting kind of guy who's into music and flying around the world going to parties, but he worked really hard behind the scenes to get the car to the position where it is, you know, the best car on the grid.
Yeah, I guess in a sense, drivers are part of the engineering team. Like, they are engineers, really, as well as drivers. It's them who has to comment on all of the changes to the car and tune it and make it better. That's probably something that people who maybe aren't as into F1 don't really realise. Hamilton obviously has had incredible success on the track, but last year he was making as many headlines for his actions outside of racing as well. He used his position as an athlete and as a celebrity to speak out on issues, particularly on Black Lives Matter and racism. He took a knee before each Grand Prix with some of the other drivers joining him, and he wore a Black Lives Matter t-shirt at the first race. In September, when he won the Tuscan Grand Prix, he unzipped his race suit to reveal a t-shirt reading, "Arrest the cops who killed Breonna Taylor." This was a bit of a new thing for Hamilton, wasn't it? This kind of making a stand for issues that he cares about.
Yeah, it's something that started happening more and more in the last few years. I think when he started his career, he just felt, you know, he was the only black driver in F1, and I think he just felt really lucky to be there, and he kind of felt that he had to keep his mouth shut to a certain extent. He was kind of presented in the sort of same mold as, you know, David Beckham, the sort of marketable British superstar, squeaky clean, you know, stick a logo on him, etc. And he started with McLaren as well. McLaren's a really, really notoriously stifling environment for drivers. You know, that there are rumours of, you know, that they have to have short haircuts and they have to dress a particular way and act a particular way in that team. Until he was basically about 30, Hamilton basically kept his outside interests to himself. He didn't really like talking about them in the media and he didn't really like showing them. But more recently, I think the death of George Floyd was a real kind of turning point with his attitude towards racism in particular in F1. And he's been much, much more outspoken in the last year, basically, and doing things like taking a knee on the grid before races and really being more and more outspoken. We saw this just before the race in Bahrain where, you know, F1's been going to Bahrain for years, but this is the first time Hamilton's really taken a stand and said, look, the human rights abuses that are going on in this country aren't right and we shouldn't allow F1 to be used as a tool to whitewash the image of regimes that are doing problematic things.
And what has the sport's response been to Hamilton speaking out? I get the sense that F1 tries to avoid politics where it can.
Yeah, I got the sense last year that F1 didn't really know what to do with all the Black Lives Matter stuff. When he wore the Breonna Taylor t-shirt on the grid, the FIA, which governs kind of global motorsport, not just F1, responded by banning non-official clothing from being worn on the podium for future races. I get a sense that F1 is getting better. I think, and you'll know this, Vicky, from the work you've done, under Liberty Media, I think they've got a much more modern kind of outward-looking attitude to maybe the way things were when the sport was run by Bernie Eccleston a few years prior. You know, before the start of this season, there was a much more managed demonstration where drivers could choose how they wanted to support racial equality, whether by taking any or not. And I think that's a much better way of doing it rather than the sports governing body trying to, you know, shove things under the carpet and pretend it isn't happening.
Hamilton has been racing, obviously, since he was a child, starting with karting. He first started racing in F1 in 2007. He was the first black driver to race in the sport. And 14 years later, he's still the only one. What has that experience been like for him to navigate? And does he think that things are changing for the positive at all? F1 has a pretty miserable record, I guess, when it comes to diversity, but surely you'd hope by now to see a bit of a greater emphasis on attracting diverse talent, even though the barriers to entry are so high.
Yeah, the problem is that, I mean, he was really open about his early experiences and the challenges and the racism, frankly, that he and his father faced when they were getting into the sport. But what he was quite good on was that it's not just about the 22 drivers on the grid, right, of which there are no black drivers, but it's also about the fact that there are no real black mechanics. There aren't really any black people working in marketing or in, you know, the kind of support functions either. So he set up what he calls the Hamilton Commission, which is a research project to try and change this, not just for the drivers on the grid, but for everything else that kind of goes into support motorsport. And one of the things is, like, you know, it costs hundreds of thousands, if not millions of pounds to get a driver from karting into F1. And that's always going to be out of reach for most people. I mean, even on the current grid, you know, like there's three or four sons of billionaires on there because they're the only people that can afford to actually get into the sport. So it's never going to be diverse. It's never going to reflect the diversity of the population, but the industry as a whole can. And I think that's why he's trying to focus his change. Some of the people I spoke to were maybe a little bit critical of him for not speaking up until now. You know, they were saying people that run existing organizations that try and get people from diverse backgrounds into motorsport were kind of saying, well, where have you been? You know, we've been doing this for 10 or 15 or 20 years, and he's only kind of coming in now towards the end of his career when he's had this platform for so long. But I think it's good to kind of see him finally using his voice and trying to affect some positive change in a sport that has been quite resistant to it over the years.
He's also been speaking out on other issues too. He's a vegan and he's quite vocal on the environment. I have to say, it does seem a bit unusual for someone who makes a living racing sort of gas-guzzling cars to try and, you know, be an activist for climate change. F1 isn't exactly the most climate-conscious of pursuits, is it?
Yeah, I was rolling my eyes. There's a branch of Neat Burger, which is the vegan restaurant that he is an investor in. And there's a branch of Neat Burger around the corner from our office in central London. And there's a big sign in there that says, thank you for saving the planet. And it's like, well, you know, you were flying around in a private jet until quite recently. But he's ditched the jet now, which I think, you know, was kind of a must if he's going to go down this environmental route. And he's invested in X44, which is a team taking part in a new electric off-road series called Extreme E. The idea is that the series is going to go around different stops around the world to raise awareness of environmental issues at each of the stops. The other thing that he said, which I think is quite interesting, is that, you know, he said that he could stop racing today and it would reduce his carbon footprint to zero, but he said that he thinks that by staying in the sport and trying to affect change from within, he can have more of an impact on the direction the sport takes in terms of greener technologies, or the direction that Mercedes takes on its road cars in terms of adopting more environmentally friendly manufacturing processes, or accelerating the adoption of battery driven cars. You know, whether you buy that or not is kind of up to you, but it seems to be something that he's thought about a lot and that he's aware of the contradiction and is trying to take steps to mitigate it.
No, it's a fair point, and I certainly can't say anything because I very much enjoy watching F1, so, you know, far from me to criticise. So Hamilton's now 36 years old. He's still presumably got a fair few years left in racing, but he must be starting to think more long-term about his life beyond F1. What's coming up?
Yeah, so I think that's what you're seeing now. I think one of the sort of side effects of him not really speaking out in the first part of his career is that he feels that, or at least people that were close to him who I spoke to said that he feels that he doesn't really have a legacy in the same way that other sports people might, and he kind of wants to develop that while he's still got the platform. So, you know, in terms of when he's going to retire, 36 is actually getting on pretty old for an F1 driver. After a while, your reaction times get slower and, you know, you don't really see many people going much beyond sort of 39, 40. So maybe he'll retire in the next few years. And then I think what I tried to get across in the piece is that, you know, he spent the last 30 years honing his driving skills, you know, learning how late to brake, how far he can push the car, how far he can stretch the tires. I think in the next 30 is going to be about learning how to negotiate this new world, because I think the challenge that he faces is that some of the things that he's pushing for, you know, action on climate change, action on diversity, are not compatible with being a sponsorable, marketable, investable figurehead for brands, which is where, frankly, F1 gets a lot of its money from. You know, you can't be a billboard and an activist. It doesn't work. So he's going to have to really negotiate that line and trying to find the route by which he can use his voice for good while also maintaining his kind of marketability as a superstar. Or he's going to have to choose one way or the other, right? And I think this is a really interesting conundrum, and I think it's going to be really, really interesting to see what he does in the next kind of 30 years and how he uses the skills he's learned on the track in this new off-track world.
I'd really recommend reading Amit's piece. You can read it on wired.co.uk or in the current print issue of Wired, gives a real insight into what makes Lewis Hamilton such a great racing driver, and also, you know, what it means to be a sporting superstar in 2021. We'll be watching the F1, I'm sure, this year. This year, Hamilton could beat Michael Schumacher's number of championships and hold another record.
It's fascinating listening to you guys, obviously both big fans of Formula One. As someone who finds Formula One really quite boring, I'd assumed, right, that Lewis Hamilton was boring, right? And from, Amit, your sort of description of him earlier in his career, he was almost managed to be boring, right? He was told to be boring and told to behave, I guess, right? And it's interesting to sort of understand the journey that he's gone on to realise that actually that's not the way that he should be, and that now he's able to show people and is confident enough to show people who he is, what he's interested in, what he's passionate about. And it's kind of scary to think that people who are as famous and powerful as Lewis Hamilton could be managed to such an extent that the world doesn't actually get to see who they are.
Yeah, I think he, when he was first coming through, you know, he was 17, 18, 19, and he made mistakes, as 17, 18 and 19-year-olds do. And he probably listened to people that didn't have his best interest at heart and wanted to use him to achieve a goal, whether it was, you know, selling more phones or furthering their own image or whatever. Like, you know, and I think his image in Britain has really suffered from those first few years when he was kind of tabloid fodder and it wasn't really him that people were seeing. And I think now he's kind of realizing that actually. And I think this actually reflects a wider change in the way celebrity culture works now, right? Individuals have much more control over their own image and they're much more willing to and able to speak directly to their fans. And I think this is a function of that as well as a function of him maturing.
It's a really fascinating profile. As Vicky says, it's in the latest issue of Wired magazine, and we'll include a link to the online version in the show notes. But you should support quality print journalism and go ahead and pick up a subscription. wired.co.uk/magazine if you want to do that. Now, our second story. Last week, I talked you through the remarkable story of a drug called Melusin, which is part of a book I've been working on for Wired about the future of medicine. This week, we're going to learn about the future of artificial intelligence from Wired's resident AI expert, Matt Burgess. How about that for an introduction? His new book on AI, which is part of the same Wired Guide series, is out now. So, Matt, why this book and why now?
Yeah, so over the last 2 decades, we've really seen an explosion in the development of AI. There's more computer power, greater quantities of data, and smarter algorithms that are now available to people working in the field. And when combined, these advancements have really dragged the field of AI, which has its origins in the 1950s, into the modern age and made the technology really useful for the first time. And some of the big breakthroughs that we've seen will be very familiar to people, and we've talked about on the podcast over the last few years, but we've seen sort of advancements and breakthroughs such as DeepMind's victory in the ancient board game of Go, which involved millions of or potential billions of possible moves, and it being able to sort of beat the world champion of that. And also sort of more broadly, the advancement of sort of self-driving car features and sort of the ability of machines to be able to interpret and identify what's happening inside images. And the AI hype cycle that has been sort of born through some of the real developments that we've seen in the last couple of decades, but particularly during sort of the 2010s and up to 2020, has seen huge amounts of money being poured into research in the area. The industry has obviously grown to be something that is worth billions, with top researchers being paid huge salaries, and big tech companies have been sort of leading the development of some of this technology. But in the last couple of years, we have seen countries around the world and governments particularly being concerned and wanting to build out their AI capabilities. And there's been talk of sort of AI arms races and countries wanting to be the leading superpowers in this domain. But in reality, though, AI still has a very long way to go. There is a lot of the current use cases that we have at the moment are quite narrow and specific. AI is very good at like individual tasks, but not very general. And a lot of the sort of AI research that's been widely popularized hasn't really made it out of of the lab and made an impact in the real world as yet.
So there are two kinds of AI, right, to speak about it very, very broadly. There's the sci-fi stuff that perhaps when people think about AI, that's in the lab or the stuff of science fiction. And then there's the stuff that is happening in the real world right now, right? And there are a number of examples of this. So right now in the UK, where we're rolling out the COVID-19 vaccine, we're using an algorithm to decide who gets a vaccine and when. It's a very basic one, but it's assessing people's risk to decide who gets a vaccine and when. We've got the exams results debacle, which shows how even very basic algorithmic systems can be fundamentally flawed. And there have been some really high profile uses of AI in policing in the UK and abroad. So we are living with AI now, but from what you're saying, Matt, we're on the precipice of truly living with AI.
Yeah, that is what is to come in the next decade or so, really, which is, I guess, what the book tries to get into. But at the moment, it is very fair to say that we are living in a world where AI is all around us, and pretty much during our daily lives at the moment, most of us will be having AI touch our lives in some way. So if you think to pretty routine systems that we use every day, such as Google search, maps, spam filters, they're all controlled by AI in some way, with AI coming up with sort of the rankings and order that we see things. But even such things as like Facebook's news feeds and Netflix recommendations, they're all AI powered in some ways. But really, I think these are all sort of like relatively sort of invisible examples of AI at the moment, and how it's sort of impacting us. And most of those that I just talked about that are being used by big tech, they're pretty sort of inconsequential in our daily lives. They don't have too much of an impact on what we're directly doing. Maybe sort of like an algorithm might come up with a bad recommendation for you on Netflix or something like that, but it's not going to change your life too much. It might just be a minor inconvenience. But I think that where AI is really starting to take off is in other parts of our lives that we have potentially even less control over. So the worlds of sort of policing, housing, work, the financial institutions that we give our money to, all of these types of organizations and bodies, which in many cases are controlled or run by governments and public services, they're all starting to experiment with AI and using AI in decision-making systems. And it's in these cases where we're starting to see that AI is a lot harder to roll out than people thought it might be, and it can have real serious impacts on people's lives. So I think, like, to really sort of illustrate how AI is basically a lot harder to use in the real world than we thought it is, there is a good example of the very first trial of AI within healthcare in the real world. And this involves a computer vision system from Google, which has been in labs proven to spot diabetic retinopathy, which is a complication of diabetes that can cause sight loss in people, and there's millions of cases of this around the world. So within labs, Google has shown that this type of technology has been able to accurately be able to identify this condition. But when it's trialed in the real world, this is where sort of some of the complications start to be seen. So it ran a trial in Thailand, and within 11 clinics that it operated in, it found that they all used lots of different technology on the ground. Only two of these 11 clinics had dedicated eye screening rooms, where the rooms could be made dark enough for the cameras used in the AI system to actually be able to take high enough quality photos. Most of these clinics had to make use of nurses' offices or general purpose rooms, where there was other clinical procedures or other things going on as well. And essentially, in some cases, they found that they had to make lots of compromises for the system to be able to work in the real world. And at a very sort of basic infrastructure level, there were problems with internet connections. So one clinic could only do these tests for sort of around 2 hours a day, and then the internet dropped out for the rest of it. And essentially, all of these sorts of real world issues about the sort of use of the technology and it rolling out practically meant that during the first 6 months of the trial, while, only 21% of the images that were captured and taken could actually be put against this algorithm and have the system used, with nurses saying that they could try the system a couple of times, but then would give up because the patients don't really want to be messed around by the AI and technology not working.
So it's great in theory and flawed in practice. And this comes back to the disconnect that there is between what we imagine is possible with AI and what's actually realistic. A slightly different example of that that people might be more familiar with is the deepfake Tom Cruise clips that went viral. So we all assumed, right, that, oh my God, this is an AI that's able to make it look like someone else is Tom Cruise, their voice, their mannerisms. In actual fact, it was basically a Hollywood film production, and we're very used to walking into a cinema when cinemas were legal and watching a film and 90% of what we see on screen to be fake, to be CGI. It's not the case that you're watching a deep fake Tom Cruise there, right? You're watching a very, very clever bit of visual effects. And that disconnect between what people assume AI can do and what AI can actually do is causing a bit of a public misunderstanding.
Definitely. And I think that with, for instance, Boston Dynamics as well, we've seen a lot of their robot videos go viral over the years. And there has been a lot of cases where a lot of that is, I mean, they haven't fully revealed all of their sort of like secret sauce that goes behind this. And there is obviously AI involved, but there's been suggestions and reports about this being sort of more programmed and less intelligent than we think. So I think that there is this sort of like disconnect very much with what AI is at the moment and what it can do. And to take another example from sort of like the reporting I was doing for this, I was speaking to a lawyer who's called Richard Robinson, and he started an AI company after working in the legal field for quite a long time. Essentially, he was saying that while he is a sort of fan of technology and was sort of working in this legal environment where he was checking lots of documents every day and sort of going through sort of quite repetitive tasks, he thought that this could be easily automated, essentially, and he could create an AI, train an AI based on previous legal data and contracts to be able to go through these documents and really scan them and pull out lots of sort of problems and really sort of like make the legal profession a lot more sort of efficient and succinct and able to do these jobs without human involvement. But when it came down to actually doing that, he said, and I think this is something that is very sort of applicable across all sorts of AI development, the reality of it was a lot harder than actually just setting up a system and doing it. And he said that the truth was that it's much more difficult than they anticipated, and that the AI that we have at the moment, there is just so many things that could be contained in these contracts that his system was scanning that you couldn't trust that the AI would be able to do this well enough. And while he says that that sort of AI will improve, the sort of system that he's built up at the end of the day, and I think that this is where very much sort of the future of work is going for a lot of people with AI, is that the system will be able to find some sort of anomalies and then alert humans. In this case, it alerts human lawyers when there's something that could be in a contract that shouldn't be there, and then they go and check it out. So it's taking away some of that sort of boring bureaucratic process and drudgery of work, essentially. But at the end of the day, the AI is not replacing humans, and it's not doing anything that sort of humans couldn't already do, just it's doing a bit faster and then essentially making the system a bit better. So some sort of augmented system of humans working with AIs.
We underestimate how good humans are at interpreting the very, very messy world in which we live, and how ill-suited AIs are at interpreting that messy world. So we've seen this with self-driving cars, right? We were meant to be whizzing around cities in fancy autonomous vehicles by now, but we're not, because the real world is messy and AI systems really struggle to understand it. And we've seen even the most basic implementations of AI in public life have been shown to be fundamentally flawed. We've mentioned the exams debacle in the UK, and that's a pretty good example. So part of that is down to bad data, right? But a lot of it is down to us not yet having a good understanding of how humans and AIs can work together. So if we're going to crack this thing, right, Matt, it comes down to collaboration.
Yeah, which is maybe sounding quite a boring thing to say, but I think is the, fundamentally the way that this is going to sort of evolve and go forward. And we need to basically understand that when we're deploying AI into the workplace or any parts of society, essentially, that people are very much involved in these systems at the end of the day. And it's people's lives are being impacted by them, whether they're having a decision made about them or whether they are making a decision that is sort of augmented. So to go back to the Google I study that I mentioned earlier, within some of the research that the team in Thailand found was this very much this idea of a human factor being involved. So at one clinic, half of the patients that were basically signed up to the study decided that they didn't want to be involved and declined to sort of participate and take any sort of role in this after finding that the results that they would be given about their eye scan would happen straight away. So previously, when they were having these types of eye tests happening, the results would take 10 weeks to arrive. And then they would then have this potential diagnosis that would see them go to another hospital, another appointment. But when they were told that their AI scans would provide results immediately and then they could have a perfect diagnosis straight away, they were like, actually, I don't necessarily want that to happen because I've got my day planned out. I don't want to have to go to a hospital, which is a couple of hours drive away this afternoon or in the next couple of days to do this. And the patients essentially weren't particularly concerned with accuracy, but more about their experience and whether it'll be a waste of their time if they have to go to a hospital for another check straight away afterwards. And I think that there's a lot of work going on in this space that's trying to solve some of these questions about how humans and machines interact. So there's work at sort of Harvard University, which is particularly sort of interesting around sort of like how humans respond to the decisions that an AI presents them. So in one experiment, researchers signed up 200 plus doctors to look at sort of example case notes of people that might have depression or potentially have depression, and these were sort of hypothetical examples, but each set of case notes described a patient's particular condition and was then followed by a sort of AI generated recommendation. Some of the recommendations were correct, some of them were incorrect, and some of them provided no recommendations at all. And that the researchers involved this in this study said that essentially when the recommendations provided by an AI was correct, overall sort of the judgment and decisions of doctors were improved. And that the overall benefit of using this AI system could be seen. But when the recommendations presented to doctors weren't correct, it could lead to sort of poorer forms of decision making. So doctors could over rely on the results that an AI was providing, or that it could cause them to basically second guess their judgment. They've done years of training on these types of conditions. They might know what is the sort of condition or the symptoms that are presenting themselves, but when they're told by an AI system that actually what they can see in front of them might not be correct, it might lead to sort of poorer decision making overall. So it sort of leads into how we're going to use these systems in the real world and sort of the checks and balances that need to be put in place to be able to really make sure that if AI is involved in decision making systems, we need to get the human part of this very right as well.
And all of these specific examples that you've talked us through are really good for highlighting something that's absolutely crucial. And as you say, it's that need for oversight. It's that need for, it's a super boring word, but regulation to make sure that we control this sort of stuff in the right way. We've reported a number of stories over the year, well, mostly you, Matt, about when accountability of algorithmic systems doesn't exist in the way that it should, that they tend to get a bit out of hand. So there's been cases where postcodes have been used by AI systems as a proxy for race, which has led to policing decisions being made that shouldn't have been made because the data that went into the AI was inadvertently biased. And that's not an isolated example. So as we move from having quite basic AI systems involved in key policymaking decisions and used by private companies to do all sorts of things, as you move from the kind of the dawn of AI having a big say in how we live our lives to this more complicated relationship with AI, getting regulation right is absolutely crucial.
It's one of the starkest things, really, that I think that we're now in sort of 2021 and there is very little regulation of any AI systems around the world. And I think that we're obviously going to see a lot more AI regulation come to the fore in the next few years. I think the EU is looking at proposals and is working out its approach to regulating high-risk AI systems at the current stage. But I think that very much we are getting into a stage where these types of systems are going to be rolled out very widely. There's lots of sort of public services and bodies in the UK that are starting to use algorithmic decision-making systems or AI-based systems that we don't actually know about. There's not any real transparency around how these systems are being used in the real world and who's using them, who's creating them, and the impact that they're having. We're starting to see some examples of cities. I think Amsterdam is one of them that's creating like a register of algorithms and AI systems that are being used in the real world. But that's one of the sort of like leading edge cases. And I think at the time of writing the book, at least there was only four systems that were listed on there. So sort of very basic, essentially. But I think that to really make sure that we can reap the benefits of AI, because there's a lot that it can do in terms of making our lives easier, making certain processes more efficient, allowing us to analyze bigger data sets and sort of learn a lot from things that humans necessarily can't understand and ascertain from patterns in data, which AI can. I think that there's a lot that we still need to get right to be able to sort of control this. And at the moment, lots of sort of the scrutiny that we're seeing of AI systems is coming from either journalists or independent researchers or bodies that have been civil society groups that have been set up to look at these. And there's not much structure and infrastructure in place in terms of regulation and controlling and sort of really understanding how AI is being used more centrally from governments, from regulators, etc. That's all still to come. And I think that basically we need to accelerate the work that's being done in that space to make sure that we can reap the benefits of AI and it's not going to negatively impact people's lives in the very near term future.
And if you want to know more about the future of artificial intelligence, you can pick up a copy of Artificial Intelligence, How Machine Learning Will Shape the Next Decade by Matt Burgess. It's available in all good bookshops, or if you're in, bookshops aren't open right now. It's available in all good online bookshop retailers, and we'll include a link in the show notes. And I'm going to put you on the spot, Matt. If anybody wants to get in touch and ask Matt Burgess any questions about the future of AI, podcast@wired.co.uk, and we'll do a Matt Burgess AI feedback special next week. And please do email, because none of you did this week, which might be because the podcast only went out a day ago. That's fine. That's our fault. podcast@wired.co.uk if you want to get in touch with us. We really do love hearing from you. Thanks so much for listening. As always, we'll be back again in a week. I promise the RSS feed will work. Until then, take care. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.